You're listening to Voices of Your Village. This is episode 201. In this episode, I got to hang out with Katie Crosby. She is one of my favorite humans over on Instagram. You might know her account, Thriving Littles. And we dove into co-regulation and self-regulation, what this looks like in parenting and interacting with tiny humans, and why one comes before the other. Folks, I have an exciting announcement. I am going to do a live workshop on highly sensitive children in a couple weeks. So we are just putting the final buttons on stuff, and you can reserve your spot in this workshop starting on Monday, December 6th. We'll send you an email and I'll share about it in my Instagram stories. If you want to come join me for a live workshop on highly sensitive children, diving into sensory sensitivities and emotional sensitivities, we are going to do just that. So head on over to Instagram next Monday, check my stories to see where you can sign up, and then come join me. I'll be going live on December 15th. And if you can't join live, no worries. As long as you have your spot in the workshop, we will send you access to the recording as well. All right, folks, let's hang out with Katie Crosby here. Let's dive in. Welcome to Voices of Your Village, a place where parents, caregivers, teachers, and experts come to support one another on this wild ride of raising tiny humans. We combine decades of experience with the latest research to create the modern parenting village. Let's dive into honest conversation about real parenting challenges so it doesn't have to be this hard. I'm your host, Alyssa Blass Campbell. Hey everyone, welcome to Voices of Your Village. Today I'm here with Katie Crosby, an OT, and y'all know I'm a sucker for an OT. Super jazzed to get to hang out with you today, Katie. How are ya?
I am good, Alyssa. Thanks so much for having me. Look forward to talking with your village.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and kind of what led you to here, what life looks like for you now?
Yes. So I am a pediatric occupational therapist, as you said, and I became interested in OT, I didn't hear about it until after undergrad. So once I heard about it, I thought, wow, this seems like a great profession in many ways. I've always been interested in mental health and psychology, and I actually ended up working in logistics after undergrad for a while, which is completely unrelated, and then took a turn and switched to OT. And that brings me to life in Chicago, where I work at a private practice full-time, and then I do Thriving Littles on the side, which is a consult service where I talk with families and kids and do video work with them.
That's awesome. So it's like virtual consults for OT?
It isn't OT, so it's informational consults based on the science and evidence-based work that I do. It's not technically therapy or billed as OT because of insurance purposes, and it's not considered telehealth. So it's more me working deeply with parents and families to go through patterns and explore the parent-child match and look at things from more of a big picture versus me seeing a child at a drop-off session and getting them on their way.
Awesome. That's so cool. I found you through Thriving Littles on Instagram and was like, yeah, let's hang, let's chat. Today I want to dive into the difference between co-regulation and self-regulation. We get so many questions about what they are, what the difference is, when one is appropriate versus another, and kind of how to move from co-reg to self-reg. I tell families all the time that we start by co-regulating, right? Like infants don't come out and they're like, oh, I know how to self-soothe. that we start by co-regulating, and then we move eventually into building self-reg skills. So I want to kind of take folks through this timeline and what that looks like. Yeah. When we're talking about co-regulation, can you kind of define that for folks for what that means and what that looks like?
Yes, absolutely. And I think the regulation terminology is more and more becoming mainstream, but and that's so cool. But it is this big word that really just means that we are emotionally organizing with the support of a trusted other. So a caregiver or an adult life, a friend. So we're always co-regulating each other based on how we're interacting throughout the day. And it's happening in moments of joy and pleasure and fun. So anytime you share joy genuinely with somebody else, or you are using emotional signaling across space, even if something happens and it's funny or you want to laugh together, anytime that you're sharing that emotional energy exchange with another, it's really co-regulation. So when we are kids, speaking about co-regulation in the emotional world, meaning most of the questions that I get from parents, which are my child is having big feelings or intensity, or they've been really angry lately. So co-regulation often comes up in talking about these more quote unquote negative range of emotional states. So when we think about meltdowns, the co-regulation aspect of it is that an adult is there with the child, guiding them through it. So it isn't the adult saying to stop crying or stop hitting or don't do that, as much as it's the adult being a guide to help the child make meaning of the behavior that they're experiencing, but most importantly, the emotion, which is the root of that behavior. So in a negative emotional range or meltdown or tantrum language that we hear, co-regulation is really what ultimately sets the stage for the child to self-regulate down the road. So it's thousands of repetitions co-regulating with a trusted adult who is regulated themselves in order for a child to develop this robust system of what it means to regulate their own body and nervous system.
I love that. When you were saying that, I was thinking of mirroring, like mirror neurons, and like if a baby is laughing and like that belly giggle, it's so delicious. And we then like, you have to smile and laugh, right? Like we're feeding off of, some people refer to it as that energy. But really this is a part of the SET method. One of them is scientific knowledge, and it's understanding this mirroring that when we show up to the table, no one's showing up with a blank slate, right? Like there is this, there are mirror neurons firing off each other. And in the same way that you're laughing when that baby laughs, if that kid is having a tantrum on aisle four, you are internally having a tantrum on aisle four, mm-hmm. right? Like mm-hmm. we are in this together. And I love that you just threw in at the end that it's our job to self-regulate in order to show up for that tiny human, that it's not their job to find the calm, it's our job to bring it. I think that that's so huge here. And
absolutely.
That the like thousands of repetitions, it's like, yes, we don't read to kids as infants expecting them to read back to us tomorrow. We read to kids as infants expecting them to read back to us years down the road. And regulation and emotional development is the same thing, that we are repeating this over and over and over. It's like reading Goodnight Moon for years. Mm-hmm. Where we're repeating it over and over and over for them to be able to build this skill set to do it on their own when we're not there one day.
Yes, and there's so much difficulty in that step of us being regulated first, right? So I think the majority of the effort or the work that I see in this whole process is that we're working on our own regulation while they're trying to figure out theirs. So there's so much that goes into just that and being available for them in the moment. So I love Alan Shore. He's a great resource for books on affect regulation and how kids develop this. And it really is tricky to do if the adult doesn't have a broad understanding of themselves and their cues in a way that they can be available for the child.
Yeah, no, that's huge. And so, I mean, life is going to happen, right? Like life's going to be busy. You're going to be trying to get out the door to go to work or trying to get a kid to bed. And it is going to be busy and stressful. And I think I have a lot in alignment with Janet Lansbury. I love Magda Gerber. I've learned a lot from her as a professional. And so Janet and I fall in line with a lot of things here, but one place that I see like a giant divide often is this idea that like, it's all going to be easy and perfect and you're just going to show up and regulate and it'll be fine, like get your stuff together. And that's just not real life. And so I think part of this is looking at, in fact, the SET method has 5 components and only one of them is adult-child interactions. The other 4 are about us as adults. What are we doing and what are we bringing to the table so that we can show up and respond instead of react? Mm-hmm. And I think, as you were just saying, like the hardest part is regulating our own emotions when we're like, I have to get out the door to go to work, right? Like, I don't have time to sit here for 20 minutes and breathe and find my calm or whatever. Like, how do we navigate this? And I think when we're looking at like teaching kiddos to regulate, whether we're co-regulating or we're trying to move towards self-reg skills, the modeling is so huge, If what they see is that like we have a hard emotion and we just yell about it or we fly off our handle without finding our calm, that's what they know.
Mm-hmm. And I think the repetition you mentioned is the same for us. So I see it as just recognizing that as humans, we will mess up and we will fly off the handle at times. And that's the way that we're wired, is reactive and more impulsive. And we have that in us somewhere. So it's bound to come out when you're ready to go out the door and trying to get somewhere and life stressors are showing up. So the repetition gives the opportunity for practice and just recognizing that shifting even a few percent every time that we're interacting, you know, trying to do a little bit better each time and repairing that when it doesn't happen and not letting all of it build up and form this self-blame or guilt or all of that stuff that really eats away from us being present in the moment when not only emotions are there, but all through life. So the repetition piece is so big for everybody.
Yeah, I love that so much. So if you have a tiny, say you're coming to the table, you're like, all right, I'm in a good place. I feel like I can find my calm. And now I want to co-regulate with this child to help them find their calm so we can move forward. Can you give us some examples of what that might look like? We'll start with like infancy and toddlerhood.
Yes. So this is a question I get all the time. And just a disclaimer, it is so individual with each child. So when I look at each child's nervous system is as unique as a fingerprint. So when we think about co-regulation, really the first step is understanding the child's cues and signals and reading them from moment to moment and adapting our interaction in a way that is beneficial for that or matches it in some way, meaning we are either upregulating or downregulating their nervous system or their body and emotions in those moments. So from infancy, there are many, I'd say, similarities in possibilities of how we can regulate an infant. And as an OT, I really think about the sensory systems, and I think everybody would, you know, should have this awareness because it's so valuable, of when we think about infantile regulation, it's really body that is the main piece of it. So I think about it as we're really closing the energy and space to be close to the infant and, you know, the body on body, using sounds in our voice in a certain way that feels organizing to the infant, using temperature. So some kids, you know, if you step outside for a minute, maybe they were too warm, so we're adjusting the temperature of the child. Or maybe they were cold and they want to be warmed up, so we're reading that. Swaddling or firm pressure is an example of this. So we go through each sensory system, and there's 8 of those. I would suggest everyone Google them and be familiar, but I'm completely biased as an OT. So there's so many good insights in sensory systems that we can use to co-regulate an infant and understand their bodies and minds and emotions a little bit better. So in a baby, I'm looking at the mother or caregiver or father being close to the infant in some way. And then as we learn the co-regulation beyond that, it's kind of like stretching it across space. So the first step is all about the sensory strategies to soothe. And we would use these if the child is dysregulated enough or disorganized, you know, having a meltdown, upset enough to need sensory strategies to soothe. So that means that they're not able to process language, which we think about most infants, you know, aren't yet ready to hear any kind of complex language, and focus on the body and our presence and our nonverbal communication systems.
Yeah, I love that. And I think I love that you pointed out that it's so different between kids. Actually, our sleep consultant's currently on maternity leave, and she has a 4.5-year-old and just had this new babe. And he came and she was like, whoa, like her world was rocked. Everything she'd known from her older daughter wasn't working to regulate this tiny human. And I showed up, he was about 3 weeks old, and it quickly realized, like, he doesn't want to be close to my body, right? Like, he wants to be farther away. He wants to be in a quiet, dark room. He wanted movement to fall asleep. Whereas her daughter, she could like snuggle her up, feed her. She'd fall asleep on her anywhere, and had very different sensory systems. And the way that she regulated was so different. And it is hard when you're in it to step back and communicate. I think especially with infants, the idea of communicating with infants, I think, is a hard thing for a lot of folks to kind of wrap their brains around, because they're not going to turn and say, hey, mom, I don't like that. But they are going to with their response, right? Like every time I brought him close to me, he literally at 3 weeks was pushing himself away from me, or like turning his body away. And so that for me, like paying attention to that, but it does take like us being able to find our calm and pay attention to their responses to kind of figure out what it is they're trying to say to us and yeah, what they're communicating there.
Yeah. In that moment where they're crying and they're really upset, it's like we're biologically triggered by that, especially if it's your child. So there's not that space for reading those subtle cues, like an infant turning away. So that's a big cue that we learn to look at, is their eye gaze. And if they are looking at us, that may mean that they want more of whatever we were doing. And if they turn their head, it's their way of saying, okay, a little bit too much, take a break, or whoa, way too much, stop and adjust and figure out how to do that differently because I didn't like that. So it is reading their little subtle cues that they have available to communicate in the early moments where they're just learning to figure out what their body is like, and that they have hands and feet and ways and tools to communicate. So it takes a lot of awareness in the moment and recognizing that their crying isn't meaningful for us and that we're not doing a good job in some way, that it is just something that they're going through and a body response that they're having, and we can figure out how to shift and adjust from there. So,
oh, I love that. I love that you just pointed out that like their crying isn't, it's not a fault to ours, right? It's not that we haven't, that we aren't doing good enough here. We're not meeting their needs. And I think, you know, there is that physiological response to want to make that crying stop. And I think especially in our youngest babes where we're like, ooh, yikes, they're crying. That means they need something and I need to figure out how to make it stop. And our sleep consultant, Rachel, she just kept saying like, he's fed. He like just woke up from a nap. Like he, all these like things, his needs are met essentially. And she's like, and I don't know what else he needs. And we just started looking at his stimulation and what helped him feel calm. And it was, again, it was different than her older daughter. And so it was harder to like see in the moment. But sometimes we have this like rush to make them stop crying, that it can be hard to pause and see what they're really communicating with us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think just knowing how tricky it can be to understand wants and needs in ourselves. And then we think about, okay, if we're still figuring out what we want and what we need and how to communicate that, I think there's so few of us that are really experts in that, are really good at thinking, okay, this is what my body's feeling. This is what I need right now. We're all pretty disconnected not to have a negative view, but if we didn't go through this co-regulation sequence thousands of repetitions in early childhood and have caregivers that were really attuned to that and reading our cues and available, then it can be really tough in these moments, one, to be available, but also not to project our own emotional experience onto the child and kind of recreate the cycle. So it's so cool. And I think we're all preaching to the choir with your podcast, but it's so cool that we're questioning these patterns and shifting things in so many ways.
Yeah, for sure. So then as we're getting older, say we're moving into toddlerhood, it will look at like ones and twos here. What does this look like? What does co-regulation look like? And how do we start to move into building that self-reg skill?
So it really can go back to, and Bruce Perry has a triangle online. If everybody, I'd love everybody to have that visual just for talking about it. It's called the learning triangle. And it goes through, so the bottom of the triangle is regulation. So when we think about the sensory strategies for soothe, the nonverbal communication, the presence, meaning regulation in that way. And then the next step higher is relate. So it's, again, becoming more distant, not you're still there, but maybe you're an arm's length away, or you're using eye contact or shared gaze to regulate instead of a body-on-body approach. And then the third up on the triangle is reason. So that's where we would bring in some language and problem solving. And for toddlerhood, we could always go back to the sensory strategies to soothe. And I think this is an area that I think caregivers have a tougher time with, because even a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old could still benefit from sensory strategies to soothe at times. But because they're older, our demands are higher and our expectations are different, and we might not be as available to offer that to them. So toddler life, I would say, is where we're often still using some of those sensory strategies, but really working on building the co-regulation in ways that is more shared. So instead of the adult doing a lot to soothe the child, the toddler is learning to read their own signals and cues and to regulate themselves with the adult there and present. So things that that may look like are, instead of if a toddler falls and gets hurt, instead of a parent or caregiver rushing in right away and picking them up, we're waiting for the child to initiate. So if they fall and they cry and then they look to the caregiver and put their arms up, that's them starting this process of, okay, I got hurt and I need, or I want my caregiver with me because I feel unsafe right now, or I feel insecure, or that was a big surprise, or it really hurt. So we're helping the child see that they can recognize that on their own, because again, we want the crying and the upset to be done biologically. But if we can slow that moment down a little bit and wait for the child to look and to signal to the parent, there's so much integration happening in that moment, because they're upset, they have to orient to their environment and maybe notice what happened, maybe notice where their caregiver is in space. So they're integrating their auditory system and their visual system and their postural system and their emotions in a way that's pretty complex. And we don't often think about when a child is slipping and hitting their knee on the curb. So there's a lot of co-regulation meet in that moment alone that can happen.
No one told us the truth about parenthood. Why? This is the podcast everyone needed before they had kids, because now that those little ones are here, whew, there is a lot to unpack. I'm Rachel Shepardota, and I am your host for the podcast No One Told Us, where we tell the truth about parenting and let you in on all the stuff you really should have known about before having kids. I am the founder of Hey Sleepy Baby, but this podcast is so much more than sleep. We'll be diving into all the topics that you really care about and need to know while you do your best job raising those adorable, tiny humans. Our goal is to just make you feel less alone and less overwhelmed. There are so many things that no one tells us before becoming a parent, and I think that we should really pull back the curtain on becoming a first-time or second-time mom or dad to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll have a little education, a little fun, and a whole lot of heart that goes into each and every episode So join me and our amazing guests each week to hear us talk about what no one told us.
If you're a parent, I invite you to join us at the Mindful Mama podcast, where it's all about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. With sometimes hilarious and always thought-provoking experts and friends, at Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have. And when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm Hunter Clark Fields, and I can't wait to see you there. Listen in to the Mindful Mama podcast.
I love that. And I think you nailed something we see often where it's expectations, right? Where we have certain expectations of a one-year-old and how they will show up in the world emotionally and language and what tools they'll have. And then we have what's often referred to as these terrible twos, where we're like expecting these tantrums and we expect these meltdowns. And now we have this term, threenager. I'm not sure if you've heard that bad boy.
Oh, yeah.
But really what I see it as in a lot of my work is that we didn't give these kids tools as a one-year-old, and then we still didn't give them the tools as a two-year-old, and now they're three and we expect them to have them, but we haven't given them to them because our expectation wasn't that when they were one and two. And now we're like, all right, buck up, sister, let's do this. Get stuff together. And they're like, I don't have stuff to get together, right? Like, and then this continues, right? Where I just had somebody the other day who was like, oh, I feel like four is the hardest age now. I'm like, right, because your expectations have risen of what they're capable of, but we haven't built their emotional toolbox for that. Mm-hmm. And I think kiddos are capable of so much more so young if we know kind of where to fit this in. And I love that you initiated this with the, like, if they fall and get hurt, because our instinct, I mean, if they're running into the street, please don't pause and wait for them to respond, right? Like, go grab them. But if they fall and get hurt and there isn't like a face of blood on this sidewalk here, and they just like bump their knee or whatever, I love that you use that as an example, because our instinct is to swoop in and make it stop because they're feeling something hard. And it sucks so bad to watch someone you love and care about, especially your tiny human, feel something that's hard. Mm-hmm. And so much of learning, I think, the self-reg skills here is knowing it's okay to feel something that's hard, and that I can build tools to find my calm so that we can problem solve, do conflict res, talk about it, move on. But first, when a kiddo is having a hard feeling, sending them that message that, like, oh, this sucks, and it's okay, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to be here with you. You have tools. And now we can bring in why we use coping strategies instead of coping mechanisms as kids are getting older, to help process. And when we're turning to these coping strategies, kiddos are going to feel it for a little longer. Like, oh, how can I help you feel calm is one of my favorite sentences, or how can I help you feel safe? Because it's triggering to them, like, there are tools to help you do that. And I'm here to be a part of it with you as you're building those.
There's so much in what you just said. I think I was taking notes on little topics because there's so much meat in there. And I think the acceptance is a big word that I was thinking of as you're talking, because just hearing that, yes, the expectations on age range can really be tricky when we're thinking about humans, because especially in those toddler preschool years, there's so much emotion that is coming out and that they're learning to feel and experience, and how it originates is this primitive, impulsive, reactive way of being it's really got a lot of strengths if you think about it, because they're so in the moment, they're fully invested, like their body, mind, and emotion is fully in the moment, which is, you know, most adults can say that very little. We're all working on it and learning, but they're really in this primitive protective mode where if they hit, it's likely a very reasonable body reaction that they're having to something that happened before that. So adapting our expectations and recognizing that if we expect that a child will never hit or they will never have a meltdown, then we're setting everybody up for a really difficult time. And if we can think and understand what's happening developmentally in those years, and that when emotion first comes out, it doesn't really look pretty or organized. It looks reactive. It looks animalistic in some ways. And it's our role to shape that and shift it and guide them and let them know, as you mentioned, that it isn't the goal to avoid all of this emotion and just shut it down and repress it and internalize it, which is what so many of us have done. And it comes out later in anxiety or depression or perfectionism or browsing social media for hours on end.
Or a lot of therapy dollars.
Or a lot of therapy dollars, yes. I think everybody could benefit from, but it's a lot easier if we can help them develop these tools in early childhood and not pick up all the shame that comes with a child hitting and then a parent saying, no, don't do that, that's not nice, but they're not really making meaning of the original emotion, so that if they hit, they feel really guilty and their anger may be displaced with fear because they know that they're not supposed to be doing that. They might get in trouble. So they're never really learning to work on that primitive urge of anger and this protective response that they're having. And it's really tough to make meaning of a sensation in the body if we're not able to go there and have an adult that's guiding us through it.
Yeah. And I think really what you touched on here is that what we're trying to develop are pro-social ways to express, right? Like, I'm 30 years old and I still have tantrums. I've just learned how to have a tantrum in a way that's pro-social, how mm-hmm. to express in a way that's pro-social, and then how to find my calm. It doesn't mean I never feel disappointment or fear or sadness or anger or embarrassment or shame or guilt or any of those hard feelings. It just means that I have learned how to express them and how to process them in a way that's pro-social. And that's what I want to give kids. I don't want them to stop feeling these hard things, because that's not how anybody lives, right? Like, that goal is unattainable. That's not how we function. And really here, when they are hitting, I look at it as like, okay, I have not given them the tools to express this in another way, right? Like, they're having a hard feeling and doing what feels comfortable to them, what they know how to do in this moment. And if I then turn and admonish that, then I'm adding shame to what they're already feeling, right? Like, I'm just layering more emotions on here. And it's really, really hard in the moment, because I had a kid slap me across the face once and I'm like, whoa, A, you're caught off guard. It sucks to be hit. And mm-hmm. it can feel like an attack on you, right? Like, also primitive for us. And it takes a lot in that moment. The only thing I could get out that was kind to her in that moment was, I'm going to go to the bathroom. But I knew if I said anything else, I was going to react instead of respond. And so I was better off leaving this child who was deeply upset about her magnetile tower crashing, leaving her sitting there crying so that I could walk away, find my calm in the bathroom, and then come back and respond. But the goal here isn't that she's going to stop throwing tantrums. It's that she's going to learn it's okay to feel mad. It's okay to feel disappointed that my magnetile tower crashed. And here is a way that I can express that mm-hmm. doesn't hurt the folks around me, or that mm-hmm. doesn't hurt myself.
Yeah, it's so high level. I mean, just you taking space and knowing that if there's a certain level of anger or intensity in our bodies, that how can we shift the moment in a way that benefits us and takes care of our nervous system, as you mentioned, because there's so many protective things that are happening in that moment if we feel threatened, and kind of questioning, okay, is she a threat to my health, wealth, or well-being right now with these intense emotions? But it takes this cognitive energy. So if our emotional body doesn't have the practice going through that, it can feel really tough to take a moment and to step back. So that's powerful when you can do that. And I think for so many kids that I see, there's a lot of them that have been more passive babies or passive toddlers. And we get a lot of, our society has a lot of emphasis on the externalized behaviors that show up. So kids that are acting out or having big emotions. But there's this whole other crew that is passive and internalizing or not getting that emotion out there. So if I have a child like that and I see them get angry and do something with their body, it's really powerful because that's telling me that their thoughts and emotions are coming together. So if they're feeling something, their body's wanting to react versus passivity, which is if you feel something, the body isn't sure what to do. It's almost like a frozen, avoidant way, if you will, because the body isn't releasing that energy in some physical way. So I sometimes see anger or body reactions as a really positive thing in progress. If a child has been passive before that and has not been showing the emotion, because if it's in us, and I think about this with teenagers, because if they're experiencing something, but not showing anybody, not acting out, not telling their, even their friends or their family what's happening, then that's where it gets dangerous with mental health. But if they're acting out, we can think about, okay, how is the behavior making sense? How can we support them? And recognizing that the behavior is communicating something. So going back to toddlers, this is where we set the foundation for them coming to us later in life and doing things that we can connect through versus isolating or shutting down.
Yeah. No, I loved so much about that. I am very expressive. People always said, oh, you wear your heart on your sleeve. I'm super expressive. And my husband's the opposite, right? Like he feels, and if it's a hard feeling, he shuts down. And it took a lot for me to, and I see it in our tiny humans too. Actually, the kiddo who slapped me across the face is I was so caught off guard because she's generally a kid who goes quiet when she has hard emotions. And I think that it's so true, especially for our teachers tuning in a classroom where we have kids who are really expressive and we're seeing these big behaviors. Those kiddos can often get our attention from the behavior so that we can start to figure out what's going on with them. But the kiddos who are quiet and are shutting down often don't get our attention because we're like, oh, they're fine, right? They're not expressing, they're fine. But when we can look at it and say, oh, I just saw this interaction happen, it means being really present and you're not going to get it all the time and that's okay. But when we can step in and say, oh, you know, I just saw, so I was in a block area with 4-year-olds and they were building this amazing like spaceship and they put it together and they were all jazzed and they were going to go to space. And another kiddo came over and was like, can I come in your spaceship? And they were like, no, there's no room. And so in that moment, that kid like sulked away. There wasn't a behavior that came after it. It would have been real easy if I wasn't there in that moment to not see it happen and not see that kiddo's hard emotions that just were going inward, right? And I just sat in the block area and I was like, oh man, I wonder how it would feel if you really wanted to play and you came over and you asked if you could play and there wasn't space for you. I didn't tell them you have to go include him. I didn't whatever. And they got to work and they made more space and they invited him into the group all on their own, which doesn't always happen that way. It was delicious. But just like recognizing, and if they hadn't made, when I saw them making space, I was like, okay, they're going to navigate this and he's going to come back into the group. And if they hadn't, I would have left the block area and went and not necessarily made them make him be included, because that doesn't make anyone feel included when somebody tells you you have to include this person. But instead gone over and been like, oh man, you really wanted to go play in that block area and they built that spaceship and there wasn't space for you. Ugh, that stinks. That must feel really lonely. And connecting with that kiddo who isn't expressing because they're still feeling.
Yes. And there's so many co-regulation things you're doing in that moment. So one, kind of reframing behavior. So if he's moving away, he's not acting out, he's not staying in it. So something might be telling us that he's not feeling safe in the moment in a way that he can adapt and shift and negotiate, if you will, or show us in some way that he wants to play. And he's not feeling secure enough with those kids to continue forward and persist. So he takes a break. Likely you were maybe getting down at his level. So using your body positioning to get down, kneel down with him and share, which is something I would suggest with that age group. because anytime we are standing over them, like this big human, we're pretty threatening and we don't realize that because the animalistic preferences or ideas that we have about the world are if somebody's bigger and taller, that they're possibly a threat. So getting down at their level, joining it, and connecting with your gaze. So he likely felt seen in that moment if you're sharing eye gaze with him and talking with him, which feeling seen, safe, soothed, and secure are all techniques or ways that we can help kids be organized and calm in the moment. So you're using your language at that point, probably changing your tone of voice, whether you recognizing it or not. I'm sure you are recognizing it. Tone of voice and speed of voice. So we might cut our speed of language in half and talk slower or talk more rhythmically or use those ways of connecting in the moment. So that's all once we're getting past the sensory strategies. That's the next level that I would suggest, is using still the presence and the nonverbal and the body language, but bringing in some tone of voice shifts and changing your prosody and connecting with them in those relating ways.
I'm Margaret.
And I'm Amy.
And together we host the podcast, What Fresh Hell? Laughing in the Face of Motherhood.
Margaret, I would say you're sort of a where are my keys kind of mom.
Correct. Sometimes a where are my kids kind of mom. Well, you're, Amy, more of a, we were supposed to leave 35 seconds ago, Mom.
I mean, touche. In each episode of What Fresh Hell, we come at a topic from our usually completely opposite perspectives. I bring the research.
And I bring kind of the gimlet eye. Like, is that research really going to work, people?
And almost 10 million downloads later, we're still laughing.
We also talk to experts in the parenting field, plus parents with stories we can all learn from.
We make each other laugh, we challenge each other's assumptions, and we have what we think is the best parenting community on the internet.
Check out What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Are you overwhelmed by the things that get in the way of you doing what you want to do? Are you looking for ways to simplify life to better align with your values? Do you want to create space in your schedule so you have room for more of the good stuff? Play, joy, relationships, gratitude, and more? If you answered yes to any of these questions, I invite you to check out Edit Your Life, a podcast to help you edit the unnecessary from your life so you have more room to enjoy the awesome. Through episodes with me, Christine Coe, and a range of super smart, compassionate, and thoughtful guests, you'll come away with big picture insights and practical ways to declutter your home, schedule, and mental space without getting bogged down by perfection. I have always believed that small moments and actions matter tremendously. My goal is to help you find agency and space in your life through doable baby steps that will leave you feeling accomplished instead of overwhelmed. Check out Edit Your Life wherever you enjoy your podcasts.
Oh, I love that. It brought up a huge point for me that, like, you can say all the right things and still not connect with a kiddo, right? An adult, right? Like, Zach can come home and be like, how was your day? With, like, no actual connection in his voice, not versus, like, hey, Lissa, how was your day? And those are two very different things. And it's the same with these tiny humans that if I'm just like, what do you need? What's up? Sorry you got hurt, right? Like, if I'm not actually in this with them, if I'm not empathizing, they're going to know.
they know
from a voice. They know from exactly our body posture. It actually made me think of, like, how often, you know, obviously right now there's a huge conversation and push towards equality in the workforce, or even just understanding what happens in the workforce in general in ways that we haven't necessarily questioned for decades, and how being a person of power affects how other people respond to you or what people, and it's the same, I think, in the caregiver-parent relationship to a child, that a child's response might partially be because of how they perceive us, either as a person of power and control and or our physical stature of being, like, larger than them and standing over them. And I think when we can get down and connect with them on a, like, hey man, I'm in this with you. You're not in trouble for this. I just want to chat with you. We can go so many different places there.
Yes. And the fixing, I think, comes with that power position. So when we want to fix or, say just the right thing to help somebody, and we think we know what they need, and we think our advice is so helpful, so why not share it? There's this a lot of discomfort with emotion that comes in that, first and foremost. So if we're wanting to fix, or if we wanted to give advice when somebody is upset, it is this discomfort with our own emotions and our experience that is being projected on that. But also it sets up exactly this power and control dynamic where versus instead of empathy, so instead of getting down at the level and sharing it and feeling something in us that really deeply recognizes what they're feeling. So yes, maybe we've never been upset about a Magna tile structure collapsing, but maybe we've been upset about something else that we worked really hard on and we put our whole life into, maybe for a short time, but they don't recognize that. And then it didn't work out and it failed in some way, or something was messed up, or something didn't fit our vision of what we expected. So if we can be comfortable with that, then we can exude empathy in the moment versus just this strategy that we've learned to help kids get through this. So yes, it's much more about the how we're saying things and the how of what we're doing and thinking about it in a really human way versus this technique that will fix and get through it in the fastest way and get us on our way. So kids really pick up on that stuff.
Totally. Yeah. We don't empathize with why somebody feels something. We empathize with what they feel. It doesn't matter if you think they should be feeling disappointment over this thing. What matters is that you know what disappointment feels like and you connect over that. I think that's huge. So when we're moving towards self-reg tools, so we're teaching kiddos, because essentially one day they are going to be in a classroom without you there, or they're going to be in a work meeting or in a partnership or whatever. How are they going to regulate themselves and their emotions so that they can respond instead of react, right? So many of these stories that I've said here today are because I have practiced so freaking much of this, where I am like, oh man, I'm working so hard on my ability to regulate in the moment, which is so dang hard, but I'm doing it so that I can respond instead of react. Mm-hmm. And that's my goal for these tiny humans, is that they learn, ooh, it's totally fine to feel this. And if I can find my calm, then there are two paths here. I can either react and fly off the handle and then deal with all of the added stuff that comes with that, usually shame and guilt and embarrassment, all those things of like, oh, I reacted now in a way that I don't love or that I knew isn't socially acceptable or whatever. Now I have more feelings to process. Don't have tools to process those either. Or I get to choose how I'm going to respond in this moment. And it is wild how early we can start to do this if we are building these toolboxes for our kiddos. And again, so much of this comes from mirroring, right? That like we are going to enter the situation feeling their energy. So if they're having a spike of cortisol, we're going to spike cortisol. What are we doing to find our calm to then be able to encourage them to find theirs before we solve the problem, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm not solving a problem with a child who is whining, crying, whatever, because they're in the amygdala and they're not ready to solve a problem. My goal is to help you leave your amygdala, your feelings brain, and come into your prefrontal cortex, your rational brain, so that we can solve this problem together. It doesn't mean it's going to happen right away, but that's my goal. And so when we're doing this, like, what does this look like as we're moving from the infant who we're snuggling to help them find their calm, or we're giving a coping mechanism to, like a pacifier or a lovey? How are we moving from that to like, oh, how are we going to find your calm in this moment so we can solve this together? How are we moving into that self-reg piece?
Such a big step, because there's so much empowerment that happens in these moments and so much resilience that's built. And there's many caregivers that have difficulty, again, sitting with their own emotion and then project that onto them in a way that it can be like the co-regulation phase is often going directly to sensory strategies, or the adults wanting to stay really enmeshed in the soothing in a way that the child doesn't really need. And it's setting up this message to the child that is saying, you need me, you need me. Mm-hmm. And it is this dance between, you know, needing and letting go and finding ways that things can work out. it is this dance between recognizing when a child really needs us or when they're ready to let go. So again, reading their signals, reading their cues, letting them initiate, letting them come to us, creating the space. And then also, first, building lots and lots of layers of joy and fun and pleasure and interaction, because that really sets the foundation for them to ultimately self-regulate. So we need lots and lots and lots of these really human shared joy interactions in order to set a foundation to self-regulate, which I think is a piece that is often missed when we're having this conversation about regulation. So when we're thinking about nurturing the brain, it isn't when the child is under stress that the brain is really shifting. So the moments that are nurturing relationship and connection and engagement in others, but also in the world, so in all learning, the moments of joy and fun and silliness and spontaneity and really the vitality for life and what that means is happening in the moments where they're feeling their best and they have a gleam in their eye, which is DR floor time language, which is the model I work with. And that's when the child's brain is lighting up in all these ways that we want for development and making the connections and setting the foundation for when things are tough or things are harder, and they can pull from these strong integrated ways of being when things are more difficult or things are more challenging. So it sets up the trust and the safety and the security that we really need in order to regulate a child when they're in a more stressed state. So if they're not trusting other humans and trusting their environment, then trying to co-regulate a child that doesn't feel that foundational safety in their world is really tricky. It takes a lot of time and a lot of process and a lot of helping them experience joy and meaning in a way that they can ultimately feel safe enough to have somebody there to co-regulate them versus reject that.
I think that's so, so, so important that like, we're not just talking about the hard emotions, but how to have joy and connection with these kiddos. And when we're looking at things like building empathy in humans, we're looking at a 4-to-1 positive to every negative thing a child hears about themselves. And I think we're often missing that. We're returning and we're responding to these negative things, but we're really missing these points of positivity. And just like, even that kiddo who's walking by where I just say, "Hey, bud, I love you," right? Just like connecting with them in these, it doesn't have to be big, like, trust building moments. In fact, it often, I think, happens in these really small moments where we say, "You know what? I have a few minutes. And right now I would love to just sit on my phone and check out, but I'm going to spend 5 minutes playing with you with my phone away," right? Like, "Hey, I would love to play with you. I have a couple minutes before dinner's ready. What would you like to play?" Right? Just like finding moments of connection.
Exactly. Yes. In daily routines, doesn't have to be this big, exactly, time sensitive thing. Although it is helpful, you know, the more the better. Quantity is important. However, just when they feel seen in their daily life, that's so powerful for setting the foundation for all this. And then when we're thinking about the moments where they're going through the tough stuff, so how to help them work more towards self-regulation, I would first and foremost say that it's all about getting them back to positive engagement with life and the world. So anytime we're going to the next step of that triangle, which is reason. So we might say, "Oh, this magnet tile is knocked over." Like that stinks. We're going through allowing the space for them to feel it and release the emotion, having a sense of empowerment in our way of being. So it's not this sympathetic tone that we're using, like, "Oh, this is so hard. This will never be over. This happens all the time." You know, not feeding into those sympathetic tones or fixing, but really empowering them and through our presence, recognizing that they can do it and they can get through this. And we fully trust them to handle the emotion on their own, although we'll be there until they're ready to do that. So helping them create the space to feel it and release it if that's what needs to happen. So sometimes emotional release is just healing, and it's either healing or communication. So if it's just healing, or if they're really tired and you know, just need some space or have had a rough day or there's vulnerable transitions going on in life, then they might just need to have more time to feel it and recognizing that. And then problem solving and thinking, I wonder if it would be good if we, I wonder if it would feel better if we play that pillow fight game you like, you know, because you were so mad about that tower breaking, like let's pillow fight and get some of this physical energy out. I probably wouldn't say that to them, but you could ultimately turn into that where it's like, let's figure out a way, almost like we would go for a run to feel better after we've stayed with the emotion, recognized what we're feeling, validated what we're feeling, and created space for it, because that's really important. It's not like we're running away from the emotion and trying to numb it. It's we're feeling it and then doing something to get us back to that positive state of mind. So it's disengagement and then re-engagement with that kind of joy and meaning in life. That is the goal, with ultimately setting them up to do that on their own. So then maybe down the road, instead of doing some numbing things, they'll have all these repetitions of getting back to something that works for them and something that's truly adaptive in regulating.
Yeah, I love it. What you really just highlighted there is the coping mechanisms versus coping strategies. We have episode 38 if people want to dive in deeper on that. But the coping mechanisms in life are those things that numb. And we all have them. It's how our body survives, right? Like, you aren't always going to have time to process something. When Rachel was going through chemo, she was like, oh man, like she was tapping into all her coping strategies. And I was like, sister, you're not going to process this right now. Like, your life is on the line. It's okay to also tap into some mechanisms to numb this so that you can survive and show up in this world. We're not always, a lot of times when we have these big things that are going to take a long time to process, death in the family, new transitions, a lot of the times we want to bring in coping strategies to help us process, but the numbing is going to happen sometimes too. But overall, what we want is for kiddos to have strategies, which are processing tools. This is the like movement, the going for a run. And some of them are preventative. Some are things that you're doing on a daily basis. Like, I'm going to exercise, or I'm going to drink enough water, I'm going to get enough sleep, to help your system stay regulated. And some you're tapping into in the moment. What do I do when I'm really feeling fear? What do I do to help my body feel safe again? How do I find that calm? And that's huge. It's so much of the work that we do in this village is like finding that calm. In fact, in our, I have a virtual membership. We meet monthly and I do a 2-hour live workshop in a different topic every month. And May was responding to tantrums to build emotional intelligence. So we went through like, how are we responding in this, in the moment, to create space, to validate, to go through coping strategies. And then I do a live Q&A 2 weeks later. And a mom came and she's like, all right, things are going well, but now my 3-year-old's yelling, no calm, mama. And I was like, oh, great. She's telling you, I'm not ready to tap into that strategy yet. Wow. I still need to feel this, right? Like, I'm still expressing this. It's like when somebody tries to stop me from crying, like, please don't. This is what my body needs to do right now. When I'm done, I will tap into a coping strategy to find my calm. I'm not going to cry for the rest of my life. I'm not going to feel sad for the rest of my life. And I know that now because I know I have a toolbox to move through it. And that's what I want for these kids. Not that we're trying to make that tantrum stop, or that we're trying to make them cry in our timeline because it's annoying and inconvenient, because it is. But that we are holding space and saying, you know what, I will be in the kitchen if you need a hug, or that if they still need space to feel and you need to walk away from it, that's okay too, that you can let them know where you'll be if they need some co-regulation and some support through this. But you can take space to take care of yourself through this too, so that you don't try and rush them through this and get to problem solving. Oh, I love this. I'm fired up.
Me too. Like, how do we stay in today and accept the things that come up and as part of life and work through it together versus all that other stuff that we'll definitely go to at times, but for it's our default, we can do some work. So
yeah, for sure. And to be real, that it's going to be inconvenient and annoying, right? Like, kids aren't like, is now a convenient time for me to throw a tantrum? Is now convenient for you? It's never going to happen that way. And part of it is accepting that for ourselves, that there are going to be things that come into our day every single day that are inconvenient because kids are learning these skills still. All right. Thank you so much for hanging out with me and diving into this. I love it. And I could get nerdy on this stuff forever. Where can people connect with you and continue to learn from you and walk alongside you?
Yeah, thank you so much, Alyssa. This has been so fun, and I'm honored to be on this podcast with you all. You can find me on Instagram at Thriving Littles, or my website is www.thrivinglittles.com. So there you can find my email and reach out to me about consults, or I have some lots and lots of information about this stuff on Instagram or Facebook. So check me out there.
Sweet. Thank you so much, Katie. I hope that you have a lovely day.
You too.
Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to Voices of Your Village. Check out the transcript at voicesofyourvillage.com. Did you know that we have a special community over on Instagram hanging out every day with more free content? Come join us at seed.and.sow, S-E-W. Take a screenshot of you tuning in, share it on the gram, and tag seed.and.sow to let me know your key takeaway. If you're digging this podcast, make sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. We love collaborating with you to raise emotionally intelligent humans.
Hey there, I'm Debbie Reber, the founder of Tilt Parenting and the author of the book Differently Wired. The mission of Tilt is to change the way neurodivergence, whether that's having a learning disability, having ADHD, being gifted, autistic, or some combination of all of the above, is perceived and experienced so differently wired kids and the parents like us raising them can truly thrive. On the Tilt Parenting podcast, I get to talk with authors, therapists, educators, and parenting experts who are committed to this mission. I ask the questions my listeners are most curious about when it comes to supporting our kids. And in turn, my guests share strategies for challenges, out-of-the-box ideas for navigating school, best practices for therapies, tips for advocating, and so many thoughtful insights on what it really takes to help our kids grow up feeling seen and respected so they can create awesome lives for themselves. I know that raising a differently wired kid can feel overwhelming and isolating, but I promise you, you are not alone, and it can feel so much better. If you're on this parenting journey, come listen to Tilt Parenting. Together, we can shift this paradigm and show up for our exceptional kids with hope, possibility, and joy.